You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Full Court Press by Tom Clute. We wound up having to go with the metal here, didn't we? The multi-billionaire is inspecting every crevice of Intuit Dome, the future home of his beloved Los Angeles Clippers, and in his estimation, a basketball mecca. Donning a hard hat and safety vest, Ballmer takes me on a tour he's given to the likes of Disney boss Bob Iger, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver, and hip-hop mogul Jay-Z. When we're walking through the building together, Ballmer says of the iconic rapper, "Nobody notices me." Perhaps, but when I walk through the sprawling project with Ballmer, none of his desires goes unnoticed. Like with Ballmer's frustration over a metal divider. Lead designer Bill Hanway reassures him there will be a transparent glass one, just as requested, when the new NBA season tips off this fall. But that's still months out on this April afternoon as the Clippers owner trudges through an obstacle course of cable drums and stacks of wood, where roughly 1,100 workers are conducting a score of beeps and grinding metal. Ballmer, though, is already in launch mode, surveying the dust-filled rooms with the same meticulous energy he once brought to Microsoft. "This and the team, that's our product," he tells me. "This is what you experience as a customer." In another life, that product might have been Windows 95 or the Xbox. Ballmer's legacy is inextricably tied to Microsoft, where he joined his old Harvard pal Bill Gates as the company's 30th employee and would eventually spend more than a decade at the helm. "We basically helped democratize computing," he notes. Ballmer remains Microsoft's largest individual shareholder, adding billions to his personal wealth amid the company's artificial intelligence boom, and still keeps a hand in the tech world, whether that's talking shop with OpenAI chief Sam Altman or popping up on CNBC to weigh in on his longtime rival Apple making its own AI splash. But Ballmer's most pressing task these days is overseeing the completion of his stately pleasure dome in Inglewood and constructing a championship-caliber club to play in it. It's a tall order, as the Clippers have never won a title in their half-century-plus existence. Despite emerging as a recurring playoff contender, they have yet to shake their rep as the little brother to the city's most celebrated team. "It's hard enough getting out of the Lakers' shadow," he admits. "We're trying to establish an identity." Ballmer wants a more intimate environment than what's offered at the cavernous Crypto.com arena, formerly Staples Center, which the Clippers have shared with the Lakers for 25 years. He urged his crew to limit gaps created by passages exiting the arena and luxury boxes. "I hate suites," Ballmer says, "to the degree that they break up the bowl." And in an effort to keep fans glued to the action, he eschewed the sprawling social spaces that are in vogue at stadiums across the major professional leagues, even though, he notes, "they tell me that's what millennials like." The team has drawn inspiration from venues across the NBA and other sports. The Wall, a 51-row, 4,500-seat section behind one of the baskets, was inspired by Viejas Arena, home of San Diego State University's basketball teams, where Ballmer attended the jersey retirement ceremony for Clipper star Kawhi Leonard. Reminiscent of the towering stands at European soccer stadiums, the Wall will be reserved for Clippers diehards. Any cheering for the visiting team or displays of opposing apparel will get you the boot. Meanwhile, the team's lockers were modeled after those used at Wimbledon and the LED halo board above the court will rival those used by NFL teams like the Los Angeles Rams and Atlanta Falcons. "That's an hellaciously expensive scoreboard," says Ballmer, gazing upward. I ask how much it cost, prompting Ballmer to turn toward Hanway. "Can I say ish?" Ballmer asks. "$100 million-ish?" "A little bit less than that," Hanway says. Ballmer settles for an estimate of 80 to 100, an unfathomable amount to pretty much everyone but him. On the day we meet, per Forbes's real-time billionaires index, Ballmer's net worth will swell by $1.8 billion to more than $125 billion. The tour wraps in one of Intuit Dome's luxury suites, where the view of the halo board is obscured by an overhang. Ballmer explains that the suites located in the corner of the arena didn't come out exactly as they were modeled, and now he will have to figure out how to make the best of what he's got. "We can't change the physics," says Ballmer. "It's just something we're going to have to think about as we sell to make sure people know exactly what they got." Ballmer, who turned 68 in March, isn't quite as spry as he was in the Microsoft days when he would bounce around on stage at company events, shrieking and flailing his arms like someone having a religious experience. If you haven't seen the videos, go to YouTube. But the eccentricities are still there, the volume still high, his kinetic energy at full tilt, never more so than at Clippers games, where he can be found hurtling through the full spectrum of human emotion. He is, to use an enduring Ballmerism, hardcore. "I saw it for myself the night before my tour of Intuit Dome, when I took in a game between the Clippers and the Denver Nuggets. Seated next to Chaz Fitzhugh, a friend since his freshman year at Harvard, Ballmer rocked and lurched in his seat, living and dying with every possession. The Clippers nursed a 2-point lead late in the fourth when all-star Paul George stepped to the line for a pair of free throws, but Ballmer couldn't bear to watch. Shielding his eyes with his left hand, Fitzhugh, like someone who had been there before, dutifully tapped Ballmer's knee after George calmly buried both shots. "The Steve you see courtside is the Steve I saw that first week," Fitzhugh tells me. Nikola Jovic, Denver's 3-time MVP, tortured the Clippers and Ballmer all night, posting one of his casually awesome triple-doubles. But Jovic's potential game winner fell short, and the Clippers escaped with a 12-point win. Ballmer rose from his seat triumphantly, alternating punches in a way that it made it look like he was swimming through air, stomping his feet on the hardwood floor, exchanging high fives with Fitzhugh and anyone else in his vicinity. It was, in other words, just another day at the office. Ballmer is avuncular and affable, his voice detouring into an affect at any moment, the decibel level typically rising with it. "I keep thinking of a word around Steve," says Silver, the NBA commissioner, loud. Ballmer also likes to clap, sometimes to signal his approval, other times when he thinks something is funny, or maybe simply because he needs the tactile and auditory fix that only a clap can provide. At Microsoft, Mick Matthews Spradlin kept a basketball in her office, which came in handy when Ballmer visited. "It was good because he had something to do with his hands, and he could pace with it," recalls Matthew Spradlin, who served as chief marketing officer before leaving the company in 2011. Mark Lukowski, a key engineer at Microsoft, who was part of the team that designed Windows NT, has similar memories of Ballmer parading around the offices with a baseball bat or tennis racket, a contrast in style to the often aloof Gates. "He's got a lot of energy," Lukowski says of Ballmer, "and he's constantly using it up." Still, Ballmer's most peculiar trait might be his ordinariness, a no-frills nature more befitting a regional manager than a billionaire executive. Friends and associates marvel at how a guy whose net worth is larger than the GDP of most countries can be so, well, normal. When Hanway first met him, Ballmer showed up solo to his office in his suburban dad uniform of khakis and a button-down, with a backpack strapped over his shoulders. Surprised by the lack of an entourage, Hanway wondered if Ballmer was waiting for anyone else. "He's like, who are you expecting?" Hanway recalled. A few years back, Clippers coach Tyronn Lue was surprised by Ballmer's willingness to make an off-season visit to Lue's hometown of Mexico, Missouri. "I had just been thinking of ways to help my community out, and I was talking to Mr. Ballmer about different ways of making that happen," Lue says. "When the season was over, he was like, 'Hey, when are we going to Mexico, Missouri?' I'm like, 'Are you serious?'" The two took Ballmer's private jet to Jefferson City before driving about an hour to Mexico, where they stayed at a Best Western. He woke up the next day and said, "That's some of the best rest I've had in a long time," Lou says. That's just who he is. Next photos, Arena Rock. Ballmer, a CEO of Microsoft, attends the Vista operating system product launch with Bill Gates in 2007. An aerial view of the Intuit Dome with James Harden before a 2015 playoff game at Staples Center. Ballmer's casual presentation belies an intensity and intelligence that are both more than a little intimidating. Within the hard-driving culture of Microsoft, employees were expected to match Ballmer's energy, or at least try to keep up. "He was an incredibly demanding guy," Matthew Spradlin says. Lukowski caught a glimpse of Ballmer's temper after revealing that he was leaving Microsoft for Google in 2004. According to Lukowski, Ballmer came unglued, calling Google's then-CEO Eric Schmidt an effing, well, use the P-word, and throwing a chair in a fit of rage. There is some dispute over the incident, with Ballmer insisting he shook but did not throw the chair. Either way, Lukowski is over it. "No hard feelings," he says. While Ballmer could be an imposing figure at Microsoft, within the Clippers organization, he is spoken of with extreme reverence, and at times in a way that verges on paternalistic. "You have no excuses, because he provides you with all the resources to be successful. I think all of us feel a great indebtedness to deliver for him," says Lawrence Frank, the Clippers president of basketball operations. "None of us want to let Steve down." Had it not been for a messy scandal a decade back, Ballmer might be still home in Washington State, pining for an NBA franchise. In 2013, while still CEO of Microsoft, Ballmer and hedge fund manager Chris Hansen led a group that tried to buy the Sacramento Kings with the intention of relocating the team to Seattle. Despite reaching an agreement with the Kings' owners, Ballmer and Hansen saw their proposal rejected by the NBA's Board of Governors. The following year, Ballmer looked into buying the Milwaukee Bucks, but the team's owner at the time, the late Senator Herb Cole, was wary of Ballmer's moving them to the Pacific Northwest and turned to other bidders. Barely a week after Cole sold the Bucks for $550 million, Clippers then-owner Donald Sterling was caught on a recording making a series of racist comments. The NBA promptly hit Sterling with a lifetime ban, forcing a sale. Ballmer won the ensuing Clippers sweepstakes for $2 billion, outbidding a group featuring David Geffen, Oprah Winfrey, Larry Ellison, and Jimmy Iovine. The saga got the small screen treatment this past June in FX's Clips, starring Ed O'Neill as Sterling, Lawrence Fishburne as then-coach Doc Rivers, and James Shanklin as Ballmer. With the Clippers, Ballmer has been more than willing to flex his financial muscles, deploying his unmatched funds to eliminate a legal hurdle that threatened to prevent Intuit Dome from being built. New York Knicks owner James Dolan's Madison Square Garden Company filed a lawsuit to block the construction of the arena, alleging that the city and its mayor violated their contract with the Forum, the former home of the Lakers that MSG bought in 2012 when they entered negotiations with Ballmer. The suit turned the city's 2018 mayoral race into a high-priced proxy fight, with Ballmer donating more than $350,000 to a committee supporting the incumbent, James T. Butts, and Dolan's MSG pouring in nearly $1 million in support of the challenger, Mark Little. In the mayor's election in Inglewood, the most you normally spend is $250,000, says Butts, who was reelected in a landslide. But litigation persisted, and after years of legal wrangling, Ballmer decided that the best solution was simply to buy the Forum for $400 million in cash, settling the dispute with MSG in the process. Ballmer has been the anti-Sterling, whose miserly ownership bordered on parody. Sterling is reportedly said to have once asked if the team could do without a trainer. The team qualified for the playoffs just 7 times in Sterling's 33 years of ownership, and in 2000, Sports Illustrated ran a cover story declaring the Clippers the worst franchise in sports history. On Ballmer's watch, the Clippers have doled out big contracts and mortgaged future assets to construct an immediate contender. In 2019, the Clippers signed Leonard, a coup made all the more significant by the fact that he chose them over the Lakers. The next day, the Clippers acquired George in a blockbuster trade to create a formidable 1-2 punch with Leonard. Last year, the team took another swing, trading for former MVP James Harden. "We want to win every year," Ballmer says. "It is a philosophy." Fitzhugh says Ballmer wants the Larry, as in the Larry O'Brien Trophy, awarded annually to the NBA champions, more than just about anything. "He really wants it bad," Fitzhugh adds. "Hey, we're not spring chickens, so we'd like to do it before they have to wheel us in here." Not every team owner is wired to win like that. Between media deals and sponsorship pacts, sports franchises can be lucrative businesses regardless of on-court performance. But Ballmer, perhaps content with his mountains of money, is clearly in it for a ring. Clippers players have taken notice. George, who now plays for the Philadelphia 76ers, says Ballmer's passion is unmatched when you compare him to other owners. "I know how competitive I am," says Chris Paul, the future Hall of Famer who played for the Clippers from 2011 to 2017, "and you can't show me too many people who are more competitive than Steve." The players bear witness to Ballmer's intensity as he attended all but 3 of the Clippers' 41 home games last season, along with a smattering of the team's road games. Ballmer does not own a residence in Los Angeles, but has been a courtside fixture since buying the team. For most games, he flies in and out on the same day, returning to his home in Bellevue, Washington, where he and his wife, Connie, raised their 3 sons, Sam, Peter, and Aaron. "My wife is a Northwesterner through and through," he says, of not owning a place in Los Angeles. "She loves it up here. She loves the climate. Her friends are all up here. Our first grandchild is up here. So no, we're never going to move. I can get down to L.A. when I want to." Under Ballmer, the Clippers have missed the playoffs just twice in 10 years, but the Larry has been painfully elusive. After trading for Harden last season, the Clippers flashed title credentials by rattling off 17 wins out of 20 from December to January. But the team dipped after the All-Star break, and Leonard, whose tenure has been marred by injuries, was sidelined by the end of the season with inflammation in his right knee. He played in just 2 games in the opening round of the playoffs as the Clippers fell in May to the Dallas Mavericks. The Clippers now head to Intuit Dome with a suddenly unpromising outlook. Leonard and Harden both re-signed with the team this year, But George left in the summer to join Philadelphia, representing a major blow to Ballmer's all-in approach. A far cry from the contender that was constructed 5 years ago, the current version of the Clippers stands well below the NBA's elite, seemingly miles from challenging for the Larry. Ballmer has little choice but to stay the course, however. The trade for George left the Clippers bereft of future draft picks, which means the team cannot easily pivot to a rebuild. Not that Ballmer has any interest in that. We are not going to have the number one pick in the NBA draft anytime soon, so we better stay in, he says. We can't say, hey, let's back up, get the second, third pick, and rebuild around that. It's not going to happen. We're in LA, so it shouldn't happen, and I don't want it to happen. A month after the team's playoff exit came another loss in the Clippers family, as Hall of Famer Jerry West, who had been working as a consultant for the team, died at age 86. He's like my basketball dad, Ballmer tells me. He's just sage. You learn from him. But the most thing I'll miss is the fun I have working with Jerry. I'll miss what he can do for our team. After the tour of Intuit Dome, I meet Ballmer at the venue the Clippers are leaving behind, in a room that has become known as his bunker. Since the arena opened as Staples Center in 1999, the Clippers operated as the third tenant, below the Los Angeles Kings and the Lakers in the pecking order. The arrangement left the Clippers with a smaller cut of revenue from the luxury suites and saddled the team with the least coveted tip-off times. He had the experience of his team playing in someone else's arena and quickly realized everything that he imagined for the experience of owning a basketball franchise and all the things he wanted for the Clippers were unlikely to ever be achieved if we didn't have our own home, says Gillian Zucker, the team's president of business operations. Silver notes that Steve came in with a vision for Intuit Dome of not just about building the best arena aesthetically, but how can I create an even better sixth man advantage? Ballmer used to hang out in the office of former Kings general manager Dean Lombardi before games and at halftime before Zucker discovered an available space near the locker rooms. Enter the bunker, a corporate-style conference room stocked with Ballmer's favorite snacks, an assortment of nuts, berries, and popcorn. We take our seats at the end of a long table, facing a bank of TVs mounted on the wall, all of which are showing NBA games. In some respects, Ballmer can seem like an open book, but he is reluctant to talk about politics. He tells me he keeps his strong opinions to himself in deference to his work on USA Facts, a website he launched in 2017 that synthesizes government data into charts and reports on a host of policy issues. Do I think this is a crazy year? Yes. Would I like to see some younger candidates? Yes. Do I have a preferred candidate? Yes, he says. Am I going to talk about that? No. Am I going to let that get in the way of the nonpartisan approach of USA Facts? No. While Ballmer has backed various candidates and groups over the years, there are fewer donations in his name than from Connie. Virtually all the recipients of the Ballmer's giving have been Democrats and progressive causes. In 2022, they donated $250,000 each in support of the successfully passed Proposition 1, which enshrined a constitutional guarantee to abortion and contraceptives in California. Their philanthropic company, the Ballmer Group, has issued grants aimed at systemic racism in housing, criminal justice reform, and climate change, among other areas of focus. Does my wife have strong views that she will express publicly that I won't? Absolutely, he says. You can check out where she's made her donations. I don't think you'll find a Republican in the group. Connie Ballmer has donated to a few Republicans, but not many. Through a representative, she declined an interview request. Ballmer credits Connie with helping to steer him into philanthropy after he retired from Microsoft, as she had already been working on child welfare issues. The Ballmer Group focuses on economic mobility, particularly in the black community. There's a real issue in this country for kids who are born into circumstances and probably can't even dream realistically of a step up economically from the situation of their birth, he says. To us, that just doesn't feel fair. Ballmer tweets little, he says, because he doubts people are interested in his nonpartisan takes or anodyne thoughts on the Clippers' performances. He's only met Twitter cum ex-owner Elon Musk briefly, though he admires Musk as an innovator. He's made key industries happen, and I respect the hell out of that, says Ballmer. Some of his ramblings on X, I don't know. Some I don't buy into. Some I do kind of buy into. Some of it is hard just to understand. He has spent a bit more time with Altman, whose OpenAI has partnered with Microsoft. He's a curious guy, says Ballmer. Over lunch, Altman had questions about sales, Ballmer recalls. I wanted to know where he thought he was taking the company. He's an impressive guy. The partnership with OpenAI has been a boon for Ballmer's old company, which he returned to the highest rung of the tech industry food chain. In an issue earlier this summer, Fortune declared that Microsoft is back on top, a reminder that for a while it wasn't. Ballmer's tenure as Microsoft CEO, a job he took in 2000 after Gates shifted to the role of chief technology officer, garnered mixed reviews. Microsoft's lost decade was the headline of a 2012 Vanity Fair article in which insiders pointed the finger at Ballmer. The company's revenue and profit both soared under his watch, but its stock price was stagnant as Microsoft got lapped by rivals in emerging sectors such as mobile and search. In one of his more infamous moments as CEO, he laughed off the commercial viability of a newly released product called the iPhone, dismissing it as too expensive. He now admits that those remarks will be etched on his tech tombstone. There are things I missed, sure, between Bill and I. We didn't get serious enough about phones in the right way. That's the one I'd say we missed. You could say search, but it was kind of more outside our wheelhouse. The notion of a device more inside of our wheelhouse, Ballmer says. That was certainly a miss. Gates and the late Paul Allen, who owned the Portland Trailblazers and Seattle Seahawks, are officially recognized as the company's founders. But there is no question that Ballmer, who joined in 1980, played a central role in turning the company into a powerhouse. Bill founded Microsoft, he says. I feel like founder number two. Ballmer helped orchestrate a deal that put the Windows operating system on IBM computers, a seminal event in Microsoft's evolution, and he professionalized the company with a staff shakeup upon his arrival. I didn't like the staff we had, he says. We cleaned out. We added people. Tuning the culture. Tuning the people. Microsoft stock has recently surged under Ballmer's successor, Satya Nadella, buttressed by its strong performance in cloud services and its backing of OpenAI. Ballmer takes a lot of pride in Nadella and doesn't mind claiming the W on the company's succession plan. We had absolutely the right guy, he says. Nobody ever has a doubt about that. But that's a guy I identified within a year or so after him joining the company. I rotated him through jobs three times to keep giving him different experiences. I mean, it's all him, but what can I do? I offer the guy experiences. The relationship between Ballmer and Gates, such as there is these days, is complicated. Ballmer was the best man at Gates' wedding, though now the two are no longer in regular contact, with Ballmer saying it was probably a few years ago when they last spoke. They're two extremely different people, Lukofsky says of Ballmer and Gates. They worked together at Microsoft because they needed each other, They don't need each other anymore. But Ballmer, admittedly a shameless Microsoft booster, remains plugged in with the goings-on at the company, and traditional rivals like Apple, which have seemed to lag behind on the AI front. Apple's being pretty pragmatic. They're using technology that was built by somebody else, and they're embedding it in ways that seem reasonably smart, and that's what they should do, Ballmer says of the company's June announcement about a partnership with OpenAI that will bring ChatGPT features into its devices. Microsoft, like Apple, is integrating these technologies into our products, he says, while pointing out that Microsoft has so many more products and scenarios because of the Office applications. He also notes that Microsoft appeals to developers because of its cloud platform and has a more nurtured relationship with OpenAI that lets us both try to serve the consumer with these technologies over the open Internet. Unlike Gates, who has sold off huge chunks of his shares in the company, Ballmer has held on to most of his. And so it is little surprise that Ballmer is extremely bullish on AI, specifically Microsoft's prospects in the AI arms race. I think Microsoft is in an outstanding position, Ballmer says, his voice turning raspy like a pirate. I think they're kicking ass. What they have on the back end? Kicking ass. The willingness to spend on capital and R&D. Kicking ass. Kicking ass. At this moment, I feel as though I'm listening to the old Ballmer, the one who used to galvanize Microsoft employees with rousing speeches. But it might actually be more like a proud papa. Clippers, Microsoft, and my kids, Ballmer says. That's what I got for babies. And Intuit Dome, he says, will be here a bit longer than I will. People may have no idea that I had anything to do with it, he adds. But man, people will know Intuit Dome for a long time. hope and change. As the threat of another Trump presidency looms, America turns its eyes to the Obamas, who remain two of the most important politicians in the world, whether they like it or not, by Kate Anderson Brower. Opening photos are a montage showing Biden, Obama, their spouses, and families. And the listener should please remember that Kate Anderson Brower's article went to press months before Biden dropped out of the race. In the days after President Joe Biden's disastrous debate performance, former President Barack Obama set aside time to do what Biden used to do for him as vice president, play devil's advocate. Over the phone, Obama took on the tough love advisory role, presenting different scenarios to Biden. Something in the conversation reportedly unsettled the current president, who has resisted calls to exit the race. The attempted assassination of former President Donald Trump only heightened the incredibly tense political environment and that question. Obama sought to be a sounding board for Biden, not a pundit. At a private White House lunch last summer, he met with Biden to air his views, dropping his signature calm. Even then, Obama believed in the very real possibility that Trump could win. But it is becoming more apparent that the values Obama cares most about, not to mention his own legacy, hang in the balance. He sees the presidency as a relay race, which begs the question of whether he privately thinks it's time for Biden to pass the baton. The progress that he wants for the country can be accomplished only with a Democrat in office. That Democrat does not have to be Joe Biden. And then came the debate. As this story was in the throes of closing, old Democratic hands who had been reluctant to speak emailed and called me to register their angst. The blame lies with Joe and Jill Biden. They set up this administration to be insular, said one insider. The nightmare of yesterday was not that Joe Biden gave a bad performance, this person added, but the problem is that he made it clear that voters were right to care about his age. A dumpster fire, declares a Democratic strategist with experience in a number of presidential campaigns, who had already confessed, "My bed is wet," before the debacle. Obama posted a statement of support on social media. "Bad debate nights happen. Trust me, I know," referring to his own 2012 debate with GOP nominee Mitt Romney. Then, after Biden's ABC News interview, meant to be damage control, David Axelrod, among Obama's most trusted advisors in the White House, called Biden dangerously out of touch. Within days, George Clooney, who headlined a Biden fundraiser in June, along with Obama and Julia Roberts, turned to the New York Times opinion pages to say, "The Joe Biden I was with 3 weeks ago at the fundraiser was not the Joe Big Effing Deal Biden of 2010. He wasn't even the Joe Biden of 2020. He was the same man we all witnessed at the debate. Obama, where art thou?" "The silence is deafening," says Representative Mike Quigley, who knows the former president and who has called on Biden to bow out of the race. "If President Obama was all in, he would be all in." "The relationship between Obama and Biden is very protected," Quigley notes. "They keep their private life and their private conversations private. I think most people who would guess about this are speculating. Donors are expressing worry, and," Quigley says, "Democratic House members are reluctant to publicly call for Biden to exit out of respect. Plus, people think wild thoughts. If the next president's a Democrat, will they not trust me?" "Obama," Quigley says, "is likely greatly concerned. The Democratic congressman believes there are more Obama people trying to encourage a change, but I'm not going to name names." There have been whispers about tension between 44 and his Veep. Even prior to the debate, the Obama camp redirected on the topic of Biden's advanced age and mental acuity in Vanity Fair's questions. Of course, there are plenty of reasons to be pessimistic right now, but Obama remains hopeful as young people step up and lead. No matter the phase of his public life, his animating principle has not changed. His goal has always been to inspire others to get involved, says Eric Schultz, a senior advisor to Obama. Obama's aides were not interested in providing insight into their boss's thinking. They couldn't get off the phone fast enough. Dan Pfeiffer, a top advisor to Obama in the White House and co-host of Pod Save America, does not touch the subject when I ask him whether his former boss wants Biden to step aside. But when I mention George Clooney's New York Times piece and ask whether Obama had a hand in it, as some people have theorized, Pfeiffer says, I know Obama pretty well, and I would be shocked if that was the case. Whether Biden exits or stays, he says, at this point there are no risk-free options. The Obamas, with their tremendous cultural and political influence, could be the closers of this race. If President Obama is saying something, people listen, says one Biden aide, adding, they have a healthy respect for each other's talents. A USA Today Suffolk University poll conducted in early May found 18% of voters cared a lot about Obama's opinion on the election, and 14% said they felt the same about former First Lady Michelle Obama. No other celebrity comes close, not Taylor, not Oprah. The party and the Democratic public, who had been pinning their hopes on the Obamas' combined megawatt star power to get an anemic Biden over the finish line, are now looking to them for what? Reassurance? Or maybe the hope of an 11th-hour endorsement of a new candidate. The Obamas can expedite a reset, says one Democratic consultant, but they can't win this for Biden. Obama is a powerhouse for Democrats. In many ways, still the most important man in the party, especially as the current president's stock crashes. This story was meant to be about how the Obamas have reimagined and are enjoying the post-presidency, and I reported over many months. But there is now a before and an after, a bright line requiring a whole new lens. By the time you read this in the print magazine, Biden may well have stepped down. Will the Obamas have hastened that to the country's satisfaction or hindered it, leaving November to chance? And maybe to Trump. For starters, Obama is the campaign's most successful fundraiser outside of Biden, the First Lady, Vice President Kamala Harris, and Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff. In late March, Obama and former President Bill Clinton appeared with Biden at a re-election fundraiser in New York that raised at least $26 million. One can assume he would be as powerful if someone else steps up to bat. For whoever the November ticket may be, whether Biden or Harris or anyone else, the more Obamas the better. If not necessarily to the Obamas themselves, who have largely steered clear of constant Trump denunciations. The barnstorming will come in the early fall, when they believe that voters are really engaged in the election. It's like the cadence of a speech, says the former president's communications director, Hannah Hankins. You're quiet at certain points, and you're loud when it matters most. Obama's major advocacy where politics are concerned has been getting younger generations involved and mentoring young politicians and community activists. President Obama's chief focus has been to build out the work of his foundation, whose mission it is to support the next generation of civic leaders, Schultz says. Their legacy is going to be so much broader, not larger, because nothing is larger than serving in the White House for 8 years, but broader than what they did in those 8 years, because they have so much runway in front of them, says Washington-based journalist Michelle Norris, a close friend of the Obamas. Someone had told President Obama that the best job in the world is being a former president of the United States. Valerie Jarrett, a close friend of the Obamas, who was a senior advisor in the White House and is now chief executive of the Barack Obama Foundation, tells me. I think he's beginning to see that's the case. One of Republican presidential candidate John McCain's favorite lines of attack against Obama was deriding him as nothing more than a celebrity. McCain's campaign ran a television ad that featured images of Obama, Britney Spears, and Paris Hilton, overlaid with audio of crowds chanting Obama, and an ominous voiceover, "He's the biggest celebrity in the world, but is he ready to lead?" 16 years later, Obama's advisors still recoil at the mention of the combined star power of the former president and first lady. They think it cheapens what the Obamas have accomplished. But the couple's global fame is undeniable, and nearly 8 years after leaving the White House, in a political landscape characterized by both polarization and whiplash, they are still figuring out the most effective way to use it. The Obamas consider Washington their home base. Roughly 24 people work in their private office and are part of what aides often refer to as Obama World. One aide describes it as one office with two principals, with staff divided nearly evenly between them. They have been leasing space at the World Wildlife Fund headquarters on 24th Street, about a mile from the $8.1 million, 8,200-square-foot Colorama house they moved into in 2017. Their decision to remain in the Capitol after the end of his term made Obama the first president since Woodrow Wilson to do so. They don't seem to care about pleasing politicos. Washington insider Susanna Quinn says that unlike the Obamas' famously gregarious Democratic predecessors, the Clintons, the Obamas were not concerned with socializing when they were in the White House, and they certainly do not care about it now, even though they've put roots down in the Capitol. They've never really connected to Washington socially, Quinn says. They stayed in their own world with original friends. It's practical to stay here because you don't have paparazzi like you do in New York and L.A. Maybe it ends up in Politico if you go out to dinner, but that's about it. When the first family was considering how they would approach their life after the White House, a source says, Michelle Obama sought advice from Laura Bush, who suggested that they get to work on whatever programs and initiatives they were planning before the completion of their presidential center, an ambitious public space slated to open in Chicago in 2026. It was advice they took to heart. First, in 2014, they created the Obama Foundation, which oversees the still-in-progress Barack Obama Presidential Center, the My Brother's Keeper Alliance, and the International Leaders Program, a six-month development and community engagement program connecting young people with leadership tools as they take on issues like climate change, immigration, and racial equity. The former president likes interacting with young people more casually and relates to them as a fellow community organizer and mentor. One of Obama's biggest interests is his My Brother's Keeper Alliance. It's a continuation of the initiative he created as president in 2014 after the killing of Trayvon Martin. Its goal is to create and expand educational and employment opportunities for boys and young men of color. And the Obamas are using the media to shape the conversation. Hillary and Chelsea Clinton formed Hidden Light Productions in 2020. In 2018, their Higher Ground Productions, named after a favorite Stevie Wonder song, signed a deal with Netflix to produce content that would go on to include films and series. And in the following years, they struck deals with Spotify, since ended, and Audible, which is owned by Amazon. They want to give a whole bunch of people a platform to tell their stories and make the world a little better, a little kinder, a little more empathetic, and a little smarter, says Joe Paulson, who was a personal aide to the former president in the White House and a frequent golf companion, and who now serves as head of business and strategy for Higher Ground. They tapped Nadia Hallgren to direct Becoming, which was her feature documentary directing debut. And they selected Dustlight, an audio production company led by a young female CEO named Misha Youssef, to produce the Michelle Obama podcast and Barack Obama and Bruce Springsteen's Renegades, Born in the USA. Higher Ground's work has championed progressive messages and uses a different venue to continue their White House work. Obama won a Best Narrator Emmy for Our Great National Parks, which highlights the need for conservation of natural resources. Waffles and Mochi is about healthy foods for children. The company's first release, American Factory, in 2019, won the Oscar for Best Documentary Feature in 2020. Obama recently narrated the four-part limited series Working, What We Do All Day, which profiles workers on different rungs of the economic ladder, and he makes the occasional cameo. We may not think about it, but we're all a part of something larger than any single one of us, and our work is one of the forces that connects us, Obama intones. And when we make sure that everyone feels their work is respected, we reinforce the trust between us that makes everything in our lives possible. Unlike most of his work, however, the show was met with mixed reviews. Time pointed to an unevenness in the storytelling and a lack of accountability in the episode about CEOs at the very top of the economic ladder. The tone is reminiscent of Democratic Party stump speeches that note the suffering of the poor, working, and middle classes, but rarely get around to holding anyone responsible for creating these conditions or effecting change. The Obamas' insertion into our daily lives through media is complicated if they are trying to move away from the world of celebrity, because, of course, it only furthers their place as global celebrities. Meghan and Harry are copying what the Obamas have put together, says Tracy Seffel, a veteran Democratic strategist who worked for Hillary Clinton. The difference with what the Obamas have done so far is their understanding of their audience. Barack sitting down with the boss, Bruce Springsteen. Well, that felt interesting and creative. But also, of course he did. Something about the Obamas continues to have a certain allure, sometimes even more so globally than in the U.S., because they don't have the baggage of our politics, says Ben Rhodes, who was Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor in the White House. Like most celebrities, the Obamas are never in one place for long. Washington may be home base, but they also have Martha's Vineyard, Chicago, and Hawaii. They bought an $11.75 million, 6,892-square-foot mansion on 29.3 acres in Edgartown, Massachusetts, and are reportedly involved in developing a property worth at least $8.7 million on the island of Oahu, though it remains unclear whether they own it. They have also held on to the red-brick Georgian-style Chicago home they've had since 2005. Shortly after they left the White House, the Obamas appeared in photos on some luxurious headline-grabbing trips, including a stop at billionaire Richard Branson's Necker Island in the British Virgin Islands, where Obama famously went kitesurfing, a trip aboard David Geffen's yacht, and a stay on the late Marlon Brando's small private atoll near Tahiti. The Obamas have spent time with Clooney and his wife Amal at their Lake Como villa and hung out in Barcelona with Steven Spielberg before a Springsteen concert, where Michelle Obama and Kate Capshaw sang backup as Springsteen and the E Street Band performed Glory Days. Some people thought the Obamas deserved a break after 8 years of unmatched scrutiny and pressure. Others were predictably less generous. "I'm glad he's having a nice time. America is on fire. quipped HBO host John Oliver. When Trump was president and the country was becoming more and more polarized, everyone wanted him back in the fray, says Schultz. Democrats wanted a savior, Republicans wanted a foil, and members of the press wanted clicks. But the Obamas were going to wait for key moments to speak up. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.